Turning our attention now to insomnia. Do you have insomnia? Do you suffer from it? How long has it been an issue for you? Have you talked about it with your doctor? What kinds of responses did you get from your doctor, from him or her? We have Dr. Ruth Benko with us, who is director of the Wisconsin Sleep Laboratory and Clinic, and she's also a professor in the Department of Psychology and Psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, past president of the Sleep Research Society and the Associated Professional Sleep Society. So great to have her with us today to talk about insomnia and perhaps hopefully dealing with it. I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments or experiences. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. And please go ahead and post on my Facebook page as well. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show and post your question or your comment there. Dr. Benko, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for taking the time to be with us today. Let's talk first of all, what's the definition, or the medical definition at least, of insomnia?
Well, insomnia can include a number of symptoms, and the first set of symptoms have to do with difficulty getting sufficient sleep. So either trouble falling asleep at the beginning of the night, waking frequently during the night or for prolonged periods during the night and having trouble getting back to sleep, waking early in the morning, earlier than you'd like to, and having trouble getting back to sleep. Then there can be symptoms of problems with sleep quality, so that although you may be sleeping, you don't feel refreshed from your sleep. Mm-hmm. And the final symptom, which is important, is that this has to somehow result in some sort of daytime consequences or dysfunction, that it impacts on your daytime performance. So simply getting less sleep than you think you should, but functioning fine during the daytime is not insomnia. Yeah. And similarly, I think it's important to understand the difference between insomnia and sleep deprivation. So sleep deprivation occurs when we don't allow ourselves sufficient opportunity to sleep and we don't get enough sleep, whereas insomnia implies that we are devoting sufficient time at night to get the sleep that we need.
How many people suffer from it? Do we have an estimate or an idea?
Well, yeah. I mean, it depends, again, on how strictly you want to define it. Probably 1 in 4 people will endorse some symptoms of insomnia. About 10 or 15% of people have problems with insomnia that lead to some sort of daytime consequences. But probably only about 5 to 10% of people have a true insomnia disorder. Now, that's still pretty high. It's a lot of people. It's one of the most common sleep disorders. But problems sleeping are experienced by, I would say, most people at some point or another, or at least an occasional basis.
We had a Facebook question from Judy who says, I have trouble sleeping, and the more I'm told mm-hmm. that this could affect my health, the less I can sleep.
Right.
Help!
that's a common problem. Or the other thing that we hear frequently is, the more I try to sleep, the harder it is to sleep. And that sort of gets at the fact that being anxious is a common sort of cause or contributor mm-hmm. to insomnia. And the more sort of revved up or anxious one is, the harder it is to sleep. And we think about insomnia as sort of having three parts to it. First, that individuals who tend to get insomnia often have some sort of underlying or predisposing factors. They tend to be sort of very stress reactive or on the anxious or sort of wired up side to begin with. Then an insomnia problem often begins with some sort of a precipitating event or stressor. It could be an illness or, some life change that is disturbing to an individual, or, psychiatric issue, whatever. And then there are perpetuating factors, things that we sort of do almost, whether intentionally or unintentionally, that contribute to the insomnia. And worrying about our sleep once we have a sleep problem is one of those perpetuating factors. The more you worry about it, the worse it's going to get.
Yeah.
It's hard to get out of that
cycle.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that gets into some of the things we do to try to treat insomnia.
Yeah, and we'll get to that in a bit as we move along here. Josh in Racine says an email, I'm a 28-year-old, I have trouble sleeping through the night. I have been on first shift for a year, but before that I was on third for 3 to 4 years. Mm-hmm. I take 5 to 10 minutes or milligrams of melatonin, trazodone, 5 milligrams a few nights as well. Bedtime is 8:30 to 9, and that's in bed while TV is off at 8. Waking up at 1:30, I get up at 4. So he's having trouble sleeping, I guess, on that. If you're moving shifts around, it could be.
Yeah, that gets into, I think, one of the, common, certainly in some groups of individuals, causes of insomnia, which is shift work. The body has its own internal clock that helps dictate when we should sleep and when we should be awake. For most people, obviously, that the idea is that you sleep during the night and are awake during the day, and that there's some variability across people. Some people are more what we call night owls.
Yeah.
They like to stay up late and have a hard time getting up in the morning. Other people are what we call larks, which means that they like to get up early and then they tend to go to bed early. That's probably a little less common. And then if you kind of interfere with your normal circadian cycle or your internal clock by trying to sleep at the wrong time, it's kind of like having chronic jet lag. And sometimes people who do shift work, if they're not working at a shift that's consistent with their own cycle, can develop a lot of problems with not only insomnia when they try to sleep, but also difficulty staying awake when they are trying to work.
You know, it's amazing to me how, for example, daylight savings in the fall, we set the clock back an hour, and just a single hour throws me off for a week or two it takes to sort of get into the rhythm of it again for a stupid hour.
Yeah, it's probably a little worse in the spring because it's easier for most people in the fall to get an extra hour of sleep because most people are a little sleep deprived. And again, what you're mostly finding is you might be waking up a little bit early. We're going to be coming up to, hopefully soon, to our other daylight savings. It means we're through the winter.
Yeah, I like this one the better.
Yeah, except, well, it's because it heralds spring, but we lose an hour of sleep. And so you're...
Somehow that doesn't bother me as much.
Well, you must be more of a morning person.
I am.
Yeah, so that's the whole idea. If you're a night person, the spring shift is a little bit harder to do because you don't like to get up early. So, yeah.
You can join in too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions or comments. We have a caller from Milwaukee who suffers from insomnia, has a treatment and a theory. She takes one melatonin pill and one generic Benadryl about an hour before bed. And she said that really helps her. Also, she thinks there's a genetic component because besides her, her mother and her daughters all suffer from it.
You want me to just comment on? Well, start with the last point. Yes, there's definitely a genetic component of insomnia. It tends to run in families. And again, that gets to this underlying predisposing factors and a little bit of, about our temperaments, of course, is and our reactivity to stress and other things is genetically determined. We also know that sleep patterns are somewhat genetically determined. There's a lot of work going on looking at that factor. So yes, if you come from a line of chronic insomnia sufferers, you're probably a little bit more likely to have that problem. In terms of things to do about insomnia, melatonin is kind of an interesting substance. Melatonin is, for most people, not necessarily directly sleep-inducing, and there's really sort of equivocal data about its use in the treatment of insomnia. It does not have an sort of an evidence-based support for that. However, what melatonin does do is that it helps to entrain the circadian clock. And, you know, particularly for people probably who have kind of more of a night owl syndrome and may have trouble initially getting to sleep, sometimes taking melatonin at the beginning of the night can help that. And some people do report that melatonin seems to make them sleepy, and in that case, it's fine to take it. Benadryl, which is an antihistamine, is something that we generally advise using with caution. Mm. It certainly can be somewhat sleep-inducing because it blocks. It's an antihistamine, and histamine is a compound made in the brain that tends to contribute to arousal or awakening. It's not the only thing. So antihistamines that can cross into the brain, like the over-the-counter ones, can often make people feel a little bit sleepy. One of the issues is, though, that when they're used regularly, they can cause tolerance, which means your body gets used to them. And then if you stop them abruptly, you'll have bad insomnia. And you'll think, well, I have insomnia and I need to keep using this pill. But what really is going on is that you're having withdrawal from not taking the Benadryl. And studies have shown that in humans, we get pretty quickly tolerant. Now, if you're using it on an occasional night here and there, it's probably going to work a little bit better and you won't run into those problems. It's not an addicting substance. And I want to distinguish that between tolerance. It's just that there are many medications, and some of them used for sleep, that are actually not addicting but are tolerizing. So we have to be careful of that.
Travis and Madison, let's turn to you. Hi, Travis.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I'm a little sleep deprived as myself. I have a 2-year-old that no matter what we do, he is just an awful sleeper. We've tried shifting his naps. Now he doesn't take a nap because at bedtime he was fighting going down for bedtime. He'd cry and scream for about 2 hours, and now he goes to bed, he sleeps for about 5.5 hours, and then he wants to be up until about 4. And we're wondering if maybe he has like some kind of sleep problem, and I wanted to know maybe if you have any suggestions.
Sure. Usually problems in young children are behavioral, and it's often sort of a multiplicity of factors. For one thing, some children are better at sort of self-soothing and settling. They're just kind of more laid back, and other kids have a harder time with that and need sort of to be taught how to do that, and usually through some behavioral methods. Young children are also really, really good at training their parents. So I always kind of, you know, think of it as it's kind of a struggle between who's going to train whom.
And we're going to continue that discussion. We'll ponder that some more and take a quick break. We'll be back right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Most of us have an occasional night when we don't sleep as well as we'd like to, but for up to 10% of people, insomnia is a chronic and debilitating condition, and some new research is showing that insomnia can have very serious consequences for our health. Larry Mueller here, happy to have you along here on the Ideas Network. Our guest today, Dr. Ruth Benka, directs the Wisconsin Sleep Laboratory and Clinic. And she's with us today till 12:30 to talk about diagnosing and treating insomnia and why it's so important to do that. Maybe you have a hard time falling asleep or staying asleep or have a family member who is. I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234 or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can leave a comment or question there. And then like the page while you're there. We'll send you regular updates on upcoming show topic, so please do that as well. And we'll be back with our guest right after this look at the news. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking today with Dr. Ruth Benka, director of the Wisconsin Sleep Laboratory and Clinic, and she's also a professor in the departments of psychology and psychiatry at the UW-Madison and past president of the Sleep Research Society and the Associated Professional Sleep Societies. Talking with her today about the health impacts of insomnia, and certainly inviting your questions and comments as we move along today. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Go to my Facebook page. You can post there as well at The Larry Mueller Show. We had a caller, Dr. Benka, who was a 2-year-old who sleeps a bit. It's really hard to get him to go to sleep. And I know you had some comments on
Right. So we're talking about in very young children. So resisting bedtime is a common behavioral problem in kids, as well as sort of what we call some of the association problems with sleep. Kids that sort of need a parent there to be able to fall asleep or can't fall asleep on their own. And this can be very disruptive of parents' sleep because the parents have to keep going in there and taking care of things. And I was talking about how some of the factors that contribute here are, the child's temperament. Some kids don't settle as well. And also how the sort of children train us to supply what they need, sometimes to the detriment of what they think they need to our own sleep. So what I usually recommend in these kinds of situations, too, though, is that, you know, we also want to make sure that, particularly with young children, that there aren't other factors that might be disrupting their sleep. For example, sleep apnea in a child, if they're snoring or noisy breathing, mm-hmm. or they might have big tonsils or big adenoids that are making it difficult, and that can contribute to arousals. Particularly young kids, can also have things like night terrors or other kinds of sleep problems that can be disruptive. So to certainly check with your pediatrician first to see what they think. Sometimes simply some behavioral interventions for kids can be helpful. There's a very good book written by Dr. Richard Ferber at Harvard. I think that's called something like Solve Your Child's Sleep Problem, and he's got some good advice in there too. But we also have behavioral specialists for kids that can help with that. And then if it's the pediatrician can't help with the problem, they can refer you in to a sleep clinic that's has a specialist in child sleep disorders, such as our clinic or some mm-hmm. of the other centers. And oftentimes we can help out as well.
Mm-hmm. You recently co-authored a meta-study that compared the results of more than, 130 recent sleep studies of people. What did you find out about the long-term health impacts of insomnia?
Well, I think, you know, we have to be sort of careful about inferring causality, that, you know, whether insomnia is causing problems. I think mm-hmm. that what we can say from what we know about insomnia right now is that insomnia is often an indicator of other medical or psychiatric problems that people have. And so people with medical problems or with psychiatric problems are far more likely to have insomnia, and vice versa. People with chronic insomnia often have other problems. And those things can interact with each other. So insomnia can make medical or psychiatric issues worse. And of course, medical and psychiatric problems can make insomnia worse. And so I always think of it first and foremost as insomnia is kind of telling us there might be some other issues going on.
Okay.
I think one thing is that, you know, people are often much more comfortable thinking, well, I just have a sleep problem. And it's not that I'm anxious or depressed or have something else going on. But that's one of the first things we always look for. Now, there are some people who just have what we call pure primary insomnia, but that's only about 10% of insomnia sufferers, that there's really nothing else going on. So that's one of the health issues, that it's a marker for maybe other health problems. There is now some emerging evidence, however, that people with chronic insomnia, probably because of chronic hyperarousal, or sort of, you know, kind of having that stress system turned on all the time, may be at risk in the long run for health consequences such as increased rates of hypertension. There's some studies that suggest maybe even increased rates of diabetes, and in older individuals, increased risks of death. But again, this seems to go with not only insomnia, but also getting a very short amount of sleep, and which insomnia can sometimes lead to, obviously. But you know, it's just a sign that you probably should go check with your doctor and let your doctor know you're having trouble sleeping, so they can dig into things a little bit more with you.
Let's go to Cindy in Madison. Thank you for waiting, Cindy. Hi.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was on the phone with your screener when you were talking about the diphenhydramine. Mm-hmm. I've been taking 50 milligrams of diphenhydramine at night for the last 5 or 6 years, and it works really well for me because I feel like I need to have that medication, quote unquote, knock me out so that I get a good sleep during the night. You know, I take it about 9:30 and then I go to bed at 10:30 and then I get up at 7:30 and I'm well rested. I'm just wondering if there's any long-term implications with doing a program like that. It's been working well for me the last 5 or 6 years, but I'm just concerned about if I keep doing that.
Well, I mean, that's a good question. On the one hand, right now it doesn't seem to be causing you any problems, but, you know, Benadryl is a medication that particularly in older individuals can have some health risks associated with, such as increased falls or cognitive impairment. So certainly it's not something I would recommend anticipating you're going to do for the rest of your life. It's not something where we have a lot of data on long-term use. I suspect that if the diphenhydramine is working so well, there might be other things that might work as similar for you. And one of the things we know in general about use of medications, whether it's Benadryl or approved sleeping medications, is that medications tend to work as long as you're taking the medications. And then when you stop taking the medications, they don't work anymore.
Right.
And what we're really trying to move towards these days is having people do what we call cognitive behavioral therapy, which is non-medication treatments for sleep, which really sort of cover the gamut of behaviors and relaxation and sort of thinking about how we improve our sleep, not just by what we do at night, but also our daytime activities. And what we now find, and this is one of the points of this article, of this review that we did, was that we know that these cognitive and behavioral treatments have better long-term efficacy than medications.
Oh, okay.
And that oftentimes a combination of medication plus cognitive behavior therapy and then eventually tapering off the medications is what works best for people. Yeah. Hmm.
Are you talking that with medications that you were talking about, are they prescription or are you talking like some other over-the-counter stuff?
Well, most of the studies have really been done with prescription medications that have been approved by the FDA for the treatment of insomnia, so comparing those to behavioral therapy. But I suspect that you'd see a similar effect with over-the-counter medications, which in general have not been shown to necessarily have the same kind of efficacy across the board as medications that have been tested. So again, I think exploring some other approaches might allow you eventually to either decrease your use of medication, either the dose or the frequency, or maybe even eliminate it over time.
Yeah.
Do you have some other things over the counter that I could try?
Well, as you know, we're talking before, if falling to sleep at the beginning of the night is a problem and it's more of a scheduling problem, sometimes
my issue, I wake up during the night. Yeah. I don't have trouble falling asleep. I sleep for a few hours and then I wake up in the middle of the night.
Yeah, I think that is something where behavioral treatments are probably going to be better. Might need other medications that might be prescription that might actually in the
help
long run
out.
Work better for you. But I really think about looking at other non-pharmacologic approaches.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for calling. Kathy in Milwaukee actually has, let's go there. Hi, Kath.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a psychologist and I specialize in sleep disorders and I offer cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. And I just wanted to mention that treatment like Dr. Benka did. It's something where I usually meet with people, I'd say 4 to 8 sessions, and a lot of what you do is work with a person on their schedule to develop a temporary schedule where you get them sleeping during a certain amount of time and then you alter that schedule. You talk with them about what to do when they can't fall asleep, and you address that anxiety that's often there. And I just wanted to thank Dr. Benka, because I think insomnia is often not really realized as something that, yes, this is an important problem, and that you can't, there is treatment available. And many of the people I meet with are very, almost resigned to their insomnia, you know, that, yes, I have this, and there's not much that you can do about it. The therapy, there aren't a lot of providers that do it, but there are a number of providers, at least in the Milwaukee area, so there is treatment out there if people want to get it.
Yeah. Thanks for calling. Comments, Dr. Benka?
Yeah, no, I think I want to reiterate the fact that, again, in our review, we found, again, that the data is, it's not a long-term therapy. It's, you know, 4 to 6 or 8 sessions, as Kathy mentioned. So it's short-term therapy. It's kind of like having a personal trainer for your sleep.
Yeah.
So kind of teach you better sleep habits and some techniques where you can feel like you have a little bit more control. And that gets back to, like, our first caller, is that when you feel like you're out of control of your sleep and you panic, it just gets worse.
Well, it makes it worse.
And the idea of the cognitive part is to sort of learn to see how, you know, it's really something you can ultimately have some control over and do some things to help it.
Thanks, Kathy.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Bob in Madison, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello. Yes, I occasionally take Ambien to fall asleep, and it works fairly well for me, but I'm a little worried about what other sort of like long-term effects it would be to take this. And also I read in some journal that Ambien, they think, actually doesn't help you sleep. They think that instead it provides amnesia, so you actually just forget that you had a poor night's sleep.
Yes. Well,
so if you could comment on all that.
Yeah. Okay. So, an occasional, you know, when you use sleeping pills intermittently, and that's one way people who have insomnia sometimes use it, and that sometimes works, and it's good because you're less likely to get tolerant, and you can often sort of stay at the same dose, and again, have that idea that there's something in the medicine chest if I really need some help. One of the side effects of many sleeping medications is that they can cause amnesia, and it can be the kind of amnesia that causes you to do things you don't remember the next day, in which case you should tell your doctor about that right away and not take that sleeping pill anymore. You know, like eating in your sleep or driving in your sleep or, you know, doing other things you shouldn't. The other thing is that sleep causes amnesia. And so one of the sort of components of insomnia, and in people who have insomnia with frequent awakenings, is that they tend to underestimate how much they sleep. They think they're awake more than they are. And that may be because of things that we may or may not be able to quantify, that their sleep is sort of light or that they're partially awake and sort of this hyperarousal. And so I don't think it's sort of so extreme that, well, you're really not sleeping anymore, but you don't remember it. It's that the quality of the sleep probably improves, and that's why it feels like you're sleeping more. So if you feel like you're awake all night, it probably is telling us something that your sleep quality isn't as good as it should be. And so the other thing about sleep to remember is that, you know, sleep has two components. It's a duration or quantity, but also a quality. What I like to say is, like, even with sleep deprivation, sleep is not like your checking account. You know, if you overdraw $10, you've got to put $10 back. If you are sleep deprived and you lose, you know, a few hours of sleep, you don't have to put exactly that many hours back, because your brain has this wonderful ability to increase the intensity of your sleep when you're sleep deprived. And the same thing may happen a little bit with insomnia. So it's most sleeping pills don't increase our duration of sleep all that much. And I think that's what you were probably what the article was probably getting at, is that, yeah, you take an Ambien and you may sleep, you know, 15 or 20 more minutes, but you feel like you sleep a lot more. So it's affecting both probably quality and quantity, although we don't really know how to measure that.
Interesting. Thanks, Bob, for calling. Scott emailed and says one thing he hasn't heard you talk about is that some people are trying to get too much sleep, and that causes them to have trouble sleeping. He said Dr. Zorba Pastor has said that there are some people who do not need 8 hours.
Yeah. Okay, that's a I'm so glad you raised that issue, because that's one of the important behavioral treatments for insomnia. So one of the things I see really frequently with people of insomnia is that the more they worry about their sleep and don't get sleep, the more time they spend in bed to try to catch some sleep. And so they're spending more and more time, you know, stressed in bed, and it causes the sleep to sort of fragment and break apart, and they're, you know, dozing here and dozing there, but not really getting good quality consolidated sleep. And the fact is that not everybody needs 8 hours of sleep. And so for people who have a lot of problems with staying asleep at night, one of the things we actually do is we restrict how many hours we let them stay in bed. And that sort of seems crazy. It's like, what do you mean? I'm not sleeping and you're telling me to not spend as much time in bed. But what we're actually trying to do is let some of that sleep deprivation build up so that when you do get to go to bed,
you actually go to sleep.
You actually go to sleep and stay asleep, and then your brain sort of gets used to staying asleep. Another sort of aspect of that is, you know, people who lie in bed and watch the clock all night. Every time I give a lecture or talk to people, I always ask, you know, who watches the clock at night? Of course, everybody raises their hands. We all do this. It's sort of like a reflex. When you wake up at night, what time is it? And that's one of the worst things you can do if you have sleep problems, because you know, you're waking yourself up, you're starting to think, you know, well, I've only been asleep for an hour and I'm already awake and that's bad. Or I'm going to have to wake up in an hour and two and maybe I won't get back to sleep and that's bad. And you know, just really get yourself stressed and anxious. I always suggest to people, if you're worried you won't get up in time, set your alarm, turn your clock around, hide it so you can't see it, and don't look at it at night. Because what happens is then your brain actually unconsciously trains you to keep waking up, because your brain is keeping track of time at night. And it's another thing that, you know, contributes to breaking up your sleep at night. But don't spend 10 hours in bed if you're having insomnia, please. Yeah.
We get up fairly early in our household during the week at 5:45. We're up and around. And I think that's fairly early. And then the weekends come, and we still wake up at 5:45 when you don't turn the alarm clock on.
Right. That means that you are probably sleeping the right amount every night. That's another good kind of rule of thumb, is that if you find yourself sleeping in an hour or more on days where you don't have to get up for work or school, you're probably not getting enough sleep. And if you go to bed and wake up at about the same time every day, whether you set the alarm or not, and are feeling okay, that's the right amount of sleep for you.
That's good to know.
Yeah, and the amount of sleep we get can vary with age, and it's probably the case that as we get older, we don't quite need as much sleep. Certainly, most, you know, older adults are not sleeping until noon like 20-somethings do. And we can also, particularly this part of the world, some people are more seasonal. They sleep more in the winter when the nights are longer, particularly with trouble getting up in the morning. And they sleep a lot less and feel more energized in the summer.
Mm. Julie in Madison, on to you. Hi, Julie.
Yes, good afternoon. Good afternoon, Dr. Benka. I'm really happy to hear this topic today. And the question I have, I'm a person who is seeking help for long-term sleep deprivation. And I'm wondering, is it possible to reverse some of the negative effects of that, i.e. cognitive issues, weight gain, diabetes, heart issues, et cetera? You know, if you're a person who has suffered, is it possible once you get back on track to reverse those?
Absolutely. And you actually remind me of a couple really important points about sleep. And again, the issues of sleep deprivation, not getting adequate sleep, is that some of the health risks about sleep are more related to sleep deprivation than insomnia per se, probably. So not getting enough sleep. And it does lead to potentially weight gain and increased appetite. We know that even if you're on a diet, if you don't sleep enough at night, you're not going to lose the fat. You're going to lose your muscle mass. So with the same amount of weight loss, sleep more. It's going to help you not eat as much and lose what you want to lose. But the effects of sleep deprivation are absolutely reversible. Once you get back to sleeping normally, we know the effects of many sleep disorders are reversible once they're treated as well. So, yes, yeah, so you can relax.
Yeah, relax on that, Julie, at least.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you very much for calling. So treatments, we're better at it now than we probably used to be. We can really get people or help people with it.
Yes, and again, I think, you know, the point of this review we just wrote is really to emphasize the importance of behavioral treatments and not just to rely on a pill. I'm a sleep doctor, so of course sleep is very fascinating, but sleep is one of the most important behaviors. It's one of the first behaviors we develop. We come into the world sleeping most of our lives, and one of the first things, you know, parents are concerned about with their children is, you know, are they sleeping and are they eating and, you know, are they eliminating? But sleep is a primary behavior, and it's something that has a whole host of associations and patterns, and behavioral approaches to sleep can help a lot. And, you know, it's a lot easier if I can just take a pill and it makes me sleep, but that doesn't work as well in the long run.
Well, it's been a real pleasure. I hope you'll come back and be with
Thank
us
you.
Again. Appreciate it very much.
It's a pleasure to be here, and thanks for all the good questions.
Yeah, there's lots of great ones. I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody, but that's usually the way it happens. Dr. Ruth Benka, director of the Wisconsin Sleep Laboratory and Clinic, professor in the departments of psychology and psychiatry at the UW-Madison. Great to have her along. And we'll deal with this issue again. I can assure you of that. Tomorrow, we'll take a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. He has lots to tell us about. Tune in then, but stay with us for now.